American History F, Part 4. Let's make a hero. Critical thinking question. How compelling could a mythology really be if it didn't have any gods? In the recent episodes of School Sucks podcast, we've been discussing the creation of a mythology about the American government. An organization that is answerable to the people that it dutifully protects and serves, while always striding forward towards some virtuous goal. But there's nothing particularly romantic about an amorphous and faceless organization. It needs to be personified. Again, a mythology is nothing without heroes, without gods. We've talked about a few of these people already, people like Jefferson, Washington. But this continues on into the future, and tourism has actually benefited from this as well. And if you think about it, if the heroification of the people who have held power in government stopped with the Founding Fathers, Washington, D.C. would just have one obelisk to marvel at, built for Washington, and one temple to worship at, built for Jefferson. But of course, if you visit that city today, you will see that many additional temples were also built. Now, at times, those servile historians or intellectuals or others who work to manage public opinion or public perception of government, of America, have gotten pretty creative with this process of hero making. They simply invent characters out of thin air, like Paul Bunyan or Uncle Sam. It's funny, if you ever drive into Troy, New York, which I don't recommend doing for any reason, there's actually a sign as you're entering that says, "Welcome to Troy, New York, the birthplace of Uncle Sam," who is not a real guy, which is interesting. But most of the time, the heroes, the gods, are made out of men who actually existed. And the criteria for rising to this god status seems to be the person needs to have a very, very significant impact. Sometimes bad, usually horrible impact on the history of the country. And that impact is tweaked, altered, until it seems to most people to be entirely good, entirely beneficial. And the person is made not just into a god, but a visionary. This is perhaps most true with the 16th president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. And Gardner Goldsmith of LibertyConspiracy.com joins me today to discuss this character. And of course, the real story of the man that the character of Abraham Lincoln was loosely based on.
Teddy Roosevelt had a well-known motto: speak softly and carry a big stick. That stick was the power of the presidency. A power that had been severely tested less than 50 years before with Abraham Lincoln. The Republican Party was established in 1854 to stop the steady expansion of slavery. It's called the Party of Abraham Lincoln. And we're proud of that. Because this man, born in a log cabin to barely literate parents, would save the soul of America and make all her people free. Lincoln, was a born storyteller. He knew when to pause, when to hurry, when to stop. He was the greatest coiner of one-liners in our nation's history, until a man named Reagan topped him. But somehow, that fine storyteller turned out to be quite the warrior as well. He took office in March of 1861, when the United States did not seem so united. Lincoln entered Washington secretly, so great were the fears of his assassination. Attacked daily in the press, vilified by half the country, the Democrats called him a third-rate lawyer, one who could not speak good grammar. He was discouraged. Lack of progress early in the war. Agonizing over the more than 600,000 soldiers killed. He was pursuing a lonely and seeming impossible task. Preserving the Union. A burden our nation has never shouldered before or since. But Lincoln loved this country and respected the Constitution. He made a friend in Kentucky. It was in the oath that I would, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. I could not take the office without taking the oath. Nor was it my view that I might take an oath to get power and break the oath in using the power. At war's end, this man, who had suffered, endured, and led, lost his life. But he had preserved the Union. He had saved the country. The country he had put first before self.
All right. I am being joined by Gardner Goldsmith, who is one of the co-hosts of Free Talk Live, as well as the host of the spectacular Liberty Conspiracy podcast. Gardner, how are you doing this evening?
Wow, I'm doing great, and I'm really great with that intro. Thanks a lot, Fred. I appreciate it.
You have a book that I should mention as well, right?
Yeah, I do, indeed.
What's the title?
It's entitled Live Free or Die, and subtitled Essays and Fiction on Liberty by New Hampshire Libertarians.
You know, the other thing, too, before we get started, I remember the first time that I heard you was on Free Talk Live. It was probably, I want to say 2006. I lived in Salem, Massachusetts, and I was listening. I was walking to the train, and you guys were talking about education, and you were telling a story about you worked in a bookstore, and
yes.
you were helping this mother of a child, or maybe grandmother of a child, who was having some real difficulties. Like she felt like he was below his appropriate reading level, and you kind of were very very quick to diagnose the problem, and it actually had something to do with the way this little boy was being taught to read in school. I thought maybe, and I remember that conversation, and I said, yes, that is sight words, whole language.
You got it.
You know, at the same time, I might have actually been catching a train from Salem to Boston to go work with a group of prospective public school teachers that I was training to take an elementary school certification exam where, strangely enough, they were being taught this method in their college program. They were being taught this whole language sight word method of teaching children to read, or probably more appropriately, teaching children not to read. So if you wanted to just start, maybe we could touch on that experience real quick, and then we can jump into this history stuff.
I'd love to, Brett. And first, I ought to mention that I'm just very grateful, as you and I were discussing before we started doing the production, just so that all the listeners know, I'm just so grateful that we get the opportunity to connect on your production, because I have admired what you've been doing for a while, and word has gotten out about what you do. And the fact that you're here in New Hampshire, and I've gotten to know you, and you're a good guy, and know all the great things you're doing – I just want to comment you on what you're endeavoring to do, and also the methodical, thoughtful way in which you do it. You know, it's a real laudable goal, and in particular, very laudable in the conversation that we're having. I'm just really glad that I can connect with you and talk about this stuff, because this is a real personal thing for me to see a guy like you standing up and explaining to people that so many of the paradigms that they are taught and in which they are inculcated in the government school systems are not only incorrect, they are destructive to productivity, to better livelihoods, to individual liberty, and treating your neighbor in a kindly fashion. They are absolutely counter to this. And, you know, people might think that this is just all rhetoric or hyperbole or something like that. But as you have drawn these things out in your productions, I think it really starts to show people, and this is a great example. What you brought up is the manifestation of decades of not just mistaken planning by the advisors and the curriculum deciders in the government schools, but actually a concerted effort on the part of certain socialist progressives to create workers, starting in the 1800s, going in through the 1900s, where not only, as you have said, have they designed the school system after the Prussian school system to create good cogs in the state machine, to have people answer to authority, but as Sam Blumenfeld pointed out to me very early on in my life, because he was friends with my father, and Sam is one of the great experts on government, the history of government education, and I'm just very grateful we've been able to have him on our podcasts. Sam pointed out to me that the government school pushers, you might say, caught very early this virus of whole language. And what they did was they wanted people like Horace Mann and others, they wanted to have a system whereby they would have good blue-collar workers and good white-collar commanders and politicians who would be sort of the platonic watchers, the black-robed oligarchs. And they just thought that that would be a better system because they didn't think that people could really be trusted to run their own lives. And so they established the school system, and inside the school system, they started to try to push for what they call whole language or look say. And what it is, and anybody who's listening, I hope they will keep this in mind, they teach children rather than the phonetic language that the Phoenicians developed in a sound symbol code system where every letter stands for a sound that the human mouth makes. And combinations of letters make new sounds, and those sounds are put together in syllables, so it's all decipherable in a very regular pattern. Rather than doing that, they give kids an entire word, and they say, recognize the word as a pictogram. And so children aren't taught the phonemes of the letters. They're not taught the specific different sounds. They're given lists of words, and if any parents happen to go in for parent-teacher conferences – and they haven't asked if the kids are being taught phonics. Just look at the books or look around the room, because a lot of times they'll have the sight words that the kids are supposed to memorize up on the wall for that week. Remember these, and they'll put them up on the board or up on a wall, and you'll see them. You can see them. And these children then come out not knowing how to decipher words they've never seen before. And so in this example that you brought up, I mean, it really touched my heart, because here was an elderly woman who was with her grandson. And he was 6 and a half, and she says, oh, he's got a problem. Well, the problem isn't the kid. It's not some physiological damage that he suffered in an accident or something like that. He hasn't been taught properly. The problem is in the government school system that teaches kids incorrectly. And they know that the very bright kids are going to be able to figure it out themselves, or their parents will teach them. So they'll be the leaders. The other kids, and I hate to sound conspiratorial, but this is on record. Sam Blumenfeld has uncovered the records of these people. This was their intent, to actually get kids through the school systems so that they would be less able to read than others. They would be the followers, and the other guys would be the leaders. It's crazy, but it's true. And so there are tons, millions of kids out there, generation after generation, who have not been taught phonics. Their lives have been hurt, and they've been damaged by the school systems. And all you have to do to test is do what I did with this little boy, to this old woman. I said, excuse me, ma'am, can I just check on something with this boy before we go any further? And she said, sure. So I wrote the word doctor down on a piece of paper. And I said to him, hey, buddy, can you tell me what this is? And he looked at it and he sort of went, dinosaur? So I knew immediately that he had been taught whole language look say. He was seeing the D, he was seeing the R at both ends of the word, and he was guessing a word that he liked, dinosaur. So I said, ma'am, there's nothing wrong with this little boy. And she said, well, what do you mean? This is the first time she had been told this, evidently. And I said, he's not being taught phonics. And it's such a simple thing, Brett. It's so sad that so many kids are slipping through the cracks here. I mean, these are real human damages we're looking at. And so I said, watch this. So I wrote down DOC on a piece of paper. And I said, hey, buddy, can you tell me what this says? You know, just go left to right and, you know, let's say, what does each letter say? So to make a long story short, he finally got it, doc. And then he did TOR on another piece of paper. He made no connection, obviously, Brett. He had not been taught how to do this on syllables. And so then I put them side by side. And I said, now what happens when you go left to right all the way across? Can you do what you did before but now go all the way across? And he did it. And he said, doctor. And he was all excited. And the woman, I mean, it was so amazing. And the woman said, what did you do? And I was like, I just taught him how to read.
Yeah.
Go home and get a phonics game, and you will skirt what these people, these statists, have done.
You know,
and they do the same thing with history. And that's what I admire so much in your direction here. I just want to mention, I really appreciate the fact that you're tearing down some of these shibboleths for these kids, because just like they haven't been taught how to read, they've been taught incorrect history. That is destructive.
Yeah, and I think, too, what you're talking about, this story that you're relaying here, is taking a language that is conveniently phonetic, and it's turning it into a language that is inconveniently symbolic. Like, if we think about trying to learn a symbol-based language like Mandarin or Cantonese, this would be incredibly difficult for most young people. And that's really what's happening with that whole look-say approach. But as I've worked more with high school kids, I've realized that it doesn't even stop there. One thing that I've heard a few kids say, and these are juniors and seniors in high school, is they'll say to me, you know, which one is an autobiography and which one is a biography? I can never remember which one is which. And it's just like this confusing problem that they can't seem to get around. So I realized that this whole treating words like pictures pedagogy that happens in elementary school is also scaled up to middle school and high school, where the teachers will give them lists of words and say, here, go look these words up in a dictionary and write down what it says in the dictionary on a piece of paper next to the word, which is, again, it's just a factory labor process. Take this thing, and stick them together. So what I found myself doing was, just like you're talking about breaking down words visually into graphemes and the sounds into phonemes, I found myself doing this with kids with the Greek and Latin roots that the entire English language is pretty much made up of. So I'd say, okay, well, take out auto, and let's put it into some other words. Automatic, automobile, autograph. And you know, the connection that can – the common denominator in all of those words is it has something to do with the self, self-moving, self-doing, self-writing your name. And autobiograph is self, life, right. The words – that even the words have root parts that I've really been convinced that I could help a junior or senior in high school – by learning 100 to 200 of these Latin and Greek roots, I could probably improve their functional vocabulary, or they could improve their functional vocabulary more appropriately by, you know, 5,000 to 6,000 words, by learning the roots that make up so many words in the English language. But this is never even taught in government school. And I think it goes back to what you're saying. This is very much an example of one of those true conspiracies. And I don't think it was a group of these socialist central planners sitting in a room saying, well, this is how we'll destroy people's ability to learn. But what they were saying is, this is how society should be run. And this is how society will be managed. We will divide people into classes, and we will decide what their role should be. One quote, I don't memorize too many quotes, but Woodrow Wilson, one of the people that, if we have time today, we could touch on a little bit, but he could, he's such a terrible bastard. He could have his own whole series. In 1909, Wilson was speaking to a group of teachers
while he was the president of Columbia Teachers College, I think this was 4 or 5 years before he became president, and I might be paraphrasing the quote just a touch, but he said, we want one class of people to have a liberal education, meaning a free education, like the real ability to learn. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks.
Yes. Precisely exactly what they wanted. That's exactly it. They just thought that certain people would not be suited to using their brains. They would be more suited to using their bodies and working in manufacturing and machining and repairing things and so on. And they just thought that that's the way society was. And they wanted to promote that. And you're right. And they started to do all these things that, if you look at it, you know, Brett, it's amazing because, you know, you have, I think, opened up a lot of people's eyes with the way you have approached this subject in the podcast that you've produced. I think it's amazing. I you know, I don't want to get too verbose. I want to keep it as quick as possible for the listener. But think about it, everybody. They've got a system that has shown, provably shown over and over and over again, that it doesn't work. They've got language arts teachers coming in giving remedial reading to kids when they're 16, 17 years old because they're functionally illiterate.
Yeah.
I mean, a kid can learn how to read at 3.5 to 4 years old within 2 weeks. He can know how to read. He can know the basic structure of it and the pattern of it. They've got, as you say, they've got people who don't know the Greek and Latin roots of words. And as you say, if they could only learn these things, they would know, be able to increase their vocabulary by hundreds more words. It would help them in life. And yet the system doesn't do this.
Right.
And the system could do it. So there's some weird disconnect. Something is holding back this government system from recognizing what actually is successful.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of it has to do with ideology. And that ideology, either ingrained and innate in many people because they worship the state and they want to walk in lockstep to the way that it always has been, and the system is set up to favor the teachers' union, which is favored by socialists and so on and so forth and run by socialists, or they just don't even know anymore. I don't know. It's sad.
Well, you know what's interesting too, and I think this provides us the nice segue to what we're discussing is people are a lot of people that I encounter, a lot of people that I would describe as statists. And as I'm producing my show, I find that it's good for me to have one or two really spirited discussions per week with a pretty hardcore statist. And I know I've used that word a lot. A statist is essentially somebody who believes that there is a socially acceptable way to do theft and violence. You know, if there's a costume or a job title that you can throw at a person, then suddenly it's okay for them to violate this principle of non-aggression. That is statism. Mm-hmm. It is a widely held but very mystical belief. And one of the things that we learn in school that results in so many people thinking just like these central planners is that, and the you know, people who are politically powerful, we're trained to think just like them because when we're young, we're also trained to be somewhat worshipful of them. And, you know, like I said, they're made into heroes at all costs. Whatever needs to be added to the story, whatever needs to be subtracted from the story. If this person had their hands on the levers of government for long enough and their impact was significant, it really seems like there has to be some kind of great mythological story that comes out of it. So the best example, and these are people that I've heard you talk about in the past on your show, Gardner. So the first one that I wanted to talk about was Lincoln. Lincoln is often, I mean, I think the introduction is that this was somebody who freed the slaves. When maybe that idea fades a little bit as people might go to upper level high school history classes or into higher education, they might learn that it's a little bit more complicated than that. But at the very least, Lincoln is this man who saved the Union. So right. What do you have to say about the mythology that surrounds Abraham Lincoln?
Well, I'm so glad this is obviously where you have wanted to take this production, Brett, because when you got in touch with me and you chatted with me about potential subjects and so on, and you offered this as a subject, I wanted to say this at the outset of the recording. So imagine it's almost at the very beginning of the recording once more, because I feel it's like a breath of fresh air anytime someone is willing to tear down some of these shibboleths that people have constructed within the statist community. And I don't even know if you can call it a community, but within the statist ranks, because this personally gets me very angry and very frustrated, because I feel like I've been ripped off. I feel like for years I was sold a bill of goods. I believed, you know, I got warm feelings about certain people that later, when you actually are, you know, willing to look up some information, or you happen to come across something, at first it might sound shocking, and then you realize, oh no, the shocking thing is that a bunch of either a bunch of dunderheads were teaching me that a pretty nasty guy was a good guy, or that they intentionally taught me that a nasty guy was a good guy. And Abraham Lincoln was not the angel that everyone depicts him as. And the problem of Abraham Lincoln, the fact that so many people have lionized Abraham Lincoln, is not just one of accidental rewriting of history, but is one of ideological intent. And what I mean by that is, since the founding of the United States government under the Constitution, and even prior to that, under the Articles of Confederation, there were at least two schools of thought. One of those schools was, of course, as we know, the agrarian, Jeffersonian, Sam Adams type of, George Mason type, anti-federalist, Cato's letters type of individual who believed in radical individualism. The concept of understanding, and by radical, of course, if you know Latin, I mean the root, going to the root, radish, the root. The root of any sort of freedom has to be an understanding that the individual owns himself. He runs his own life. Now, that took some variance there, but there was the Jeffersonian side of try to keep government as small as possible, try to acknowledge as often as possible that the individual should run his own life. Don't set up a government that's going to take people's money that much. Try to keep restrictions on it. Try to allow the states to compete with each other. Well, they wouldn't go as far as I would, which is to eliminate the state entirely, the state in the generic sense. But at least they wanted to have some sense of competing areas where if you didn't like it, you could escape and go to a different state, and you could vote with your feet. You could get away. Now, on the other side of it, you had the Hamiltonians. The Hamiltonians were very much in favor of much more central planning, cronyism. Very much tied to banks and special interests and mercantilist interests that Adam Smith warned about in 1776. And so when the Articles of Confederation were passed, they had numerous presidents before George Washington, about which people are never taught. They used some of the problems that the states were bringing up, for example, putting tariffs against each other's products and printing their own money, as a way to basically – rewrite the rules for the existence of the government, and they came up with the Constitution. Now, at the time, many people thought that that was actually sort of a slick coup that the Hamiltonians and pro-federalists did, because originally the Constitutional Convention was not supposed to have been for rewriting a whole new government system. It was supposed to have been to just amend the Articles of Confederation. But the people who were pro-centrists, the people who were pro so-called Federalists, who were actually pro-centrist, the Alexander Hamiltons, the John Adams, and people like that. And at the time, the James Madisons, although Madison sort of picked up some alarms along the way, those people were very much in favor of getting the government involved in building things, in hiring companies to do things, in central banking, controlling the money supply. And obviously, many of them wanted this, in particular Alexander Hamilton, who was just a guy that I look at as a criminal in United States history, an ideological criminal anyway. He was very much in favor of this. He had a lot of friends in banking. He had risen to the top because of the friends he had made in the banking and building communities and government. He knew that there was a nexus that he could help promote that would help these people, these special interests, and help the politicians who helped these people. So it would become perpetuating. And that split, that fissure, just grew and grew and grew. After Alexander Hamilton, you had Henry Clay. and Henry Clay was an ideological scion of Hamilton's, and he called what he wanted to do internal improvements, these special favors and special projects, which were contrary to the Constitution, as James Madison wrote, contrary to the original intent of the Interstate Commerce Clause. The Interstate Commerce Clause does not grant the federal government control over anything that goes over state borders. It does not grant the government power to hand out money for special projects or anything like that. So if you look at that snapshot at the beginning of the 1800s, late 1700s into early 1800s from Hamilton and Henry Clay, Henry Clay then influenced a guy named Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln we'll go through some of the examples of why Abraham Lincoln should not be seen as a good guy. Abraham Lincoln was never in favor of the United States Constitution. He was never a constitutionalist, even though as president, he swore an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution. He was a hypocrite, and people knew he was a hypocrite when he was in Illinois in their representative body. They used to call him Leaping Lincoln, because rather than go with a vote that he didn't like, he jumped out a window in the representative body, and Thomas DiLorenzo has written a lot of great stuff on him. He jumped out so that they couldn't have a quorum. The man was a lot less honest. He was not Honest Abe, and he was a pretty disastrous person. He was a dangerous man, and, of course, there were millions of lives that were lost to testify to that in the Civil War.
Yeah, and you know, I think even this mythology continues with scholars and historians today. I'm sure you're familiar with the best-selling book that was actually written by a pretty wonderful woman that I've had the pleasure of meeting a few times. And when we're not talking about history or politics, she's just absolutely delightful. The book was Team of Rivals, and it was written by
Doris Kearns Goodwin.
And the angle that she takes is an interesting one, because I think it gets the heroification gets a little bit different at that level when, you know, Doris Kearns Goodwin, who is a wonderful woman, but she's picked some interesting heroes. Lincoln, Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson.
Well, she got her start with Lyndon Johnson. She got a special thing to go in and cover the Johnson administration. That was her first book. She was like a young woman then. You know, she loves the status. She just adores them.
She, you know, her treatment in that book is that Lincoln was just this dynamic political leader who had the ability to bring, you know, conflicting interests together. And he would put, the title suggests that he would put people who were political rivals into his cabinet in this sort of fight towards progress. May the best ideas win. And, you know, it's a different treatment, but as I flipped through that book, I really didn't see anything approaching the drilling down that someone like Tom DiLorenzo did with.
And what's fascinating to me about her is, it's almost when I look at what she writes, it's almost like People Magazine history. You know, she doesn't really get into ideology so much and the clash of ideologies as she does little anecdotes to make the people so warm and fuzzy and human. And she would, you know, discuss, for example, Roosevelt. Oh, did you know that Roosevelt and Stalin would sit in, or Roosevelt and Churchill would sit and have cigars and brandy till late in the, like, I don't care what they're sipping. Give me a break. You know, let's talk about some concrete things. Roosevelt's people, and we'll talk about this, you know, later on if you want to. We can talk about Roosevelt anytime. Roosevelt's people worshiped Stalin. They thought Mussolini was great. I mean, a guy, Stalin had an eye collection on his desk categorized by color. And when he died, they burned the eye collection. They were in pickle jars. And you could smell it from like a half a mile away on the wind. And Roosevelt loved this guy. You know, these are stark differences between real history as we would like to express it to people and what the pop media people accept as history from Doris Kearns Goodwin, which is all sort of like, oh, well, let's feel good about all the people who helped make the United States great. Well, guess what? You don't make a country great by stepping on individual liberty and destroying the very rules for the nation. It's just bogus. You know, I have to mention, in the Team of Rivals thing, what is fascinating is that you don't get any real substantive conversation about some of the real criticism that was leveled against Abraham Lincoln during his presidency. And no, I would love to see her in a conversation and have someone say, excuse me, Doris, we know that not only did they call him Leaping Lincoln, but we also know that when he became a congressman, he made more money off of the land that he bought, knowing that the Transcontinental Railroad might be passed, than he did his entire career as a lawyer. This guy, Abraham Lincoln, goes to Congress, helps put forward the Transcontinental Railroad, and he's got land, and he helps shift it towards the land that he owns. If you look at the course of the Transcontinental Railroad, it's all zigzaggy. It's not as efficiently done as it could be. And the reason is because all the politicians had to go through their different areas. Either they own land or their friends own land. And it's vastly corrupt. So Lincoln made more money off of that than he did his entire career in a so-called honest living in doing legal practice. I don't know. I'd never heard her talk about that. She didn't have it in her book. I wonder why. Because Lincoln is supposed to be a hero.
And it's interesting, too, that these things that you've mentioned occur at a point in Lincoln's life or a point in Lincoln's career before a history textbook would even mention his name. I mean, there's very little. I mean, you have the Lincoln-Douglas debates are probably the first time that this man, Abraham Lincoln, is mentioned in a government school history textbook. And, you know, these are great points, and it's important to really understand who this man was, where he came from, what led up to him being president. But what's interesting too is that the thing that he is most lauded for is pretty much the Civil War, which yeah. The average estimate of total dead in the war is somewhere between 500,000 and 600,000 people. Incredibly destructive. It does so much to centralize control into the hands of the federal government, into the hands of the executive. But this is Lincoln's great achievement, according to the government school history book. So, if we were going to run through that quickly, what would you want to add about that?
Well, you know, isn't it wild, Brett? I'm just sitting here sort of as an aside. I'm just amazed. It's like a breath of fresh air. Knowing that you're in New Hampshire and we have so many people now who can converse about these things. And now with the technology, people can listen to your productions. They can listen to my productions. They get Free Talk Live. They can hear other things from Stefan and other folks. And you just say to yourself, this is awesome. It's so nice to be able to actually talk to people. I used to drive down to the Foundation for Economic Education every month just so that I could have conversations like this before we had all these internet connections. It's awesome. But moving from Lincoln as the congressman into Lincoln in the presidency, well, it's very interesting because you look at the bubbling of the Civil War and people – Ken Burns, I don't know how he can go out outside the filmmaker Ken Burns because he wears his heart on his sleeve so much. Every sleeve he has must be stained.
Yeah.
But, he does, what, eight hours or 12 hours of a documentary, which everybody just falls over themselves on the Civil War. You know, it's got a bunch of sepia tone photographs, a bunch of music from the time played by fiddlers, and a bunch of pan and scan stuff where it's, you know, they zoom across and everybody thinks this is just great documentary filmmaking. Substantively, there are some problems with it. And for example, one of the problems is the claim that the Civil War was about slavery as the prima facie reason for the war. And that is false. It was not about slavery per se. It was about the North and the South. The North imposing its will through the legislature and the presidency of Abraham Lincoln to force the South to buy products from Northern manufacturing interests rather than the South buying the products as they had been from foreign countries for less. And they were going to impose all sorts of problems on the South. They were going to impose all sorts of tariffs and things. And the South, the Southern states, knew that their economic best interest was not being served. Now you mix into it the slavery issue, and you've got a real problem there. Abraham Lincoln and his friends, they knew that if the South seceded, they would be much more powerful as an economic interest. they would start to open up their own industrial centers. They had the agricultural centers. Abraham Lincoln, despite the fact that the union, I don't understand how you can have a union without being able to get out of the union.
Right.
I don't understand how you can be married and then say, well, this marriage, I'm going to enforce it at the point of a gun.
Right.
But evidently, yeah, that's what Abraham Lincoln thought. And so you go from him being in Congress to him in the Civil War, and you say he did certain things. And there, it's all on record. DeLorenzo describes all this stuff. He did certain things to actually set up the people at Fort Sumter to fire the first shot. And he sent false communiques to them, all sorts of things to make it look like the North was going to do something and the South ended up firing the first shot. He suckered them into firing the first shot. And now I can understand why so many of the people in the South, they hate Abraham Lincoln, because he did certain things to essentially get this thing rolling. And then he broke the Constitution over and over and over again with things like, for example, an unconstitutional income tax. There was something in the Constitution that allowed an income tax, but he imposed one just out of nowhere. He lifted habeas corpus himself. And habeas corpus is, of course, the opportunity for American citizens or those being tried in an American system. Even if you're not an American and you're being tried in an American court, you're supposed to be able to have your day in court and have the evidence presented against you. That's habeas corpus, the body of evidence. Well, he suspended habeas corpus. He can't do that. The president, according to the Congress, according to the Constitution, has no power to lift habeas corpus. Only Congress can do that. And it's supposed to be everywhere. He lifted habeas corpus. So that is supposed to, well, anyway, Congress is supposed to do that. And when they do it, they can't do it selectively for certain individuals. They have to do it across the board for all American citizens. But he did it himself. When a Supreme Court justice, there was going to be a ruling on this. The Supreme Court was going to rule that that was unconstitutional. He sent magistrates to go arrest members of the Supreme Court who were going to rule against him. He arrested, and I'll read this to you here. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, I've got one of Tom DiLorenzo's books here. Yes, here it is on page 27 of Lincoln Unmasked. George Orwell himself would blush at the assertion that Lincoln was a champion of the Constitution. The only way one could conceivably make this argument is to base the argument exclusively on a few nice things that Lincoln said about the Constitution while generally ignoring his actions. For example, he launched an invasion without the consent of Congress, illegally suspended the writ of habeas corpus, and imprisoned tens of thousands of northern political opponents. He shut down some 300 opposition newspapers, censored all telegraph communication, imprisoned a large percentage of the duly elected legislature of Maryland, as well as the mayor of Baltimore, illegally orchestrated the secession of West Virginia, deported the most outspoken member of the Democratic opposition, Congressman Clement Vallandigham of Ohio, systematically disarmed the border states in violation of the Second Amendment, and effectively declared himself dictator. The gatekeepers try to excuse all of this, but their words ring hollow to anyone familiar with the historical facts. Yeah, the people in Maryland, they weren't even going to secede. They were just going to stay neutral, Brett. And he imprisoned them for like 3 months.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this is – I was going to use something like this path of – this, you know, blazing this path of destruction, which immediately makes me think of Sherman and Sheridan terrorizing people in Georgia.
But we're not even
there yet. You know, Lincoln blazing this path of destruction, grabbing this power, establishing an income tax, suspending habeas corpus, the draft that led to, of course, the famous riots in places like New York City. And of course, the 600,000 dead and how all of that by the history we get is swept under a carpet and it's reframed as this issue of Lincoln and the Union against slavery, when the reality is that Lincoln is actually – now, slavery – sometimes I think that this treatment of Lincoln can – people get kind of clever and they think that they can reframe it again as like we have this apologist position for slavery, which is insane. I mean, it's you know, one of the top two atrocities that I think have happened on this plot of land in the last 500 years. And there's no defense. There's no apology. There's no rationalization for that. But what's important to point out is that Lincoln is willing to protect the institution of slavery in states that are not rebellious.
Precisely. Absolutely right. And We'll stick with that point in just a minute, but I just want to add, you bring to mind a terrific book by Jeffrey Rogers Hummel called Freeing Slaves, Enslaving Free Men. And we can talk about that later, but you're absolutely right. Here you have people saying that he's the man who freed the slaves. The Emancipation Proclamation didn't free any slaves in the North.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is what really gets me. And again, it brings me back to the inception of the production here, because I was so satisfied when you told me you wanted to talk about this, because like I said, I feel like I've been sold a bill of goods. When I was in fourth grade, it was the bicentennial, right? So I've got a pretty decent teacher in Emma Wheeler. She's sort of a patriotic woman, so on and so forth. But I didn't know at the time that she didn't have the information that we have about Abraham Lincoln. I was recruited because I was the tallest kid or one of the tallest kids in my class, very tall and skinny guy. I was supposed to play Abraham Lincoln, and I had to recite the Gettysburg Address. And I thought Abraham Lincoln was awesome. Oh, wow, he's on the back of the penny. Look, there's that little tiny Lincoln. That's so cool. And he freed the slaves, and he was so tough, and this is awesome. And I memorized the entire Gettysburg Address. And I recited it. I had a stovetop hat and a tuxedo jacket and a beard that I had made that looped around my ears and came down. And I got up and did that in front of every parent in the school twice for two different sessions on the 4th of July. And everybody patted me on the back. And now I sit there and I say, this is terrible. I have carried that opinion over to now my niece, who was going through the same school system, obviously different teachers. But she and I were chatting one time, and George Bush came in. I said, oh, geez, George Bush. She goes, oh, you don't like him? I was like, nah, no. She goes, well, what about Bill Clinton? She's about seven, maybe. And I said, no, sorry, Bree. She goes, well, I know a president who is pretty good, Abraham Lincoln. He freed the slaves. Now, you know, I'm talking to a very bright kid. She's 6, 7 years old. How do you explain to a child who idolizes somebody now because everybody thinks he was a good – just being told he was a good guy. He was a great man, a great man. When you hear that, you want to feel good about other people. So you're inclined to say, oh, yeah, he was great. And then I started to explain it to her. I said, you know, Brittany, he didn't really free the slaves. He issued a proclamation, which he wasn't even supposed to be able to do himself. Congress had something about that. There was a question whether Congress could even do something like that. But also, he didn't free the slaves in the North. She goes, well, what do you mean? I said, the Emancipation Proclamation was a military strategy to try to disrupt life on the plantation in the South. She said, really? And she got it. She understood. Now, I don't think it takes much to teach kids this, and they can decide for themselves whether it's right or wrong to say that Abraham Lincoln was a saint for doing what he did, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting, too, when you mention how that conversation started, that it was George W. Bush appearing on television. And it's an interesting question when we look at the treatment. When we look at what Lincoln really did and we look at the way that he is treated in the folklore of government school textbooks, if we could fast forward 100 years, and pretend for a minute or assume for a minute that this institution of government education will still exist, hopefully it won't, what is the treatment in the books of somebody like George Bush? Is he a hero? Because I think, you know, and I've said that to people before, I think it's a nice way to get status thinking when somebody says, somebody who tends to lean more towards the Democratic side of political matters brings up George Bush, and I say, history will write him as one of the greatest presidents. So that gets them heated up, like, what are you talking about? I'm angry, but I want to know more about why would you say that?
Yes.
And I do a basic roll call of the people that are considered to be the heroes of American history. FDR, Abraham Lincoln, when you get to higher education, Woodrow Wilson. These were people who had, by the time they died, had so much blood on their hands and had you were always told about how we live in a nation of laws. We live under the rule of law, and then we look at the leadership and what are their laws, which is basically the Constitution as far as their limitations are concerned. I don't hold that to be any kind of sacrosanct document, but it's a useful reference to see how much respect leaders have for the limitations of their power.
Absolutely.
And when we look at people like Lincoln and Roosevelt, who have been made into such heroes, what does the future hold for George Bush? It's an interesting question.
That is a very, very good question. You wonder whether ideologically some of the people who are on the other side of the political fence from him, the Democrats, will recognize that ideologically he was much more to their liking. Of growth of the state, of favors for business, favors for government, the TARP bailouts, Medicaid Part D or Medicare Part D, all these types of things. I mean, the warfare state Democrats, as much as they like to promote themselves as the peace party, Democrats have been just as guilty in engaging in foreign conflicts and so-called wars, but undeclared, of course, and killing foreigners, as the Republicans have. So I wonder down the line whether or not George Bush will be seen as somebody who was a big promoter of their ideology. And again, I hope people can take themselves out of this party schism, this party false dichotomy that they have, because, as I said, it goes all the way back to Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. And I put a bookmark in Tom DiLorenzo's book, The Real Lincoln, at page 80 before we were going to chat. Because as I mentioned, we had the Alexander Hamilton movement over into Henry Clay. Abraham Lincoln then comes up, and he is a scion of Henry Clay. And I mentioned how Henry Clay was a scion ideologically of Hamilton. Well, the same thing with Lincoln. And he openly said, I am an ideological descendant, essentially. I'm paraphrasing, of Henry Clay. I believe in internal improvements. In other words, he believed in mercantilism and special favors. And James Madison in 1816 said this about something that Henry Clay did on page 80 in Lincoln. DiLorenzo writes, and this shows you, these schisms have been here all the time. Madison, when the Bank of the United States was rechartered in 1816, Henry Clay placed in the bill a $1.5 million appropriation for canal and road building schemes. On his very last day in office, Madison vetoed the bill. And quote, he said, "It was time to teach the nation a lesson in constitutionalism. The bill," he said, "failed to take into account the fact that Congress had enumerated powers under Section 8 of the first article of the Constitution, and it does not appear that the power proposed to be exercised in the bill is among the enumerated powers, or that it falls by any just interpretation within the power to make the laws necessary and proper for carrying out other constitutional powers into execution." He's absolutely right. And, of course, as you say, they disregard this. So maybe one of the big lessons we should learn is that a paper document cannot stand against the intentions of politicians who get into government.
Yeah. I think absolutely. I think that's a great point. I think history has demonstrated that all too well. And, it's interesting that we're kind of back and forth between Bush and Lincoln here at the same time. But it really seems that the concentration of power into the executive really ramps up with the presidency of Abraham Lincoln very,
absolutely,
very quickly. And it's interesting to see. The other interesting thing about this, too, is this is what power does to people. They ignore what their limitations are supposed to be, which is why I said that the Constitution is an interesting point of reference more than something that we would consider a sacrosanct document that really should govern a group of people or a government govern a government over a group of people. I mean, that's not what I'm in favor of, but the other.
Well, Brett, I just want to mention for those people who aren't familiar with the anarcho-capitalist or free market argument of societal interactions, free market interactions, to build ourselves with the ability to exclude bad actors and not associate with them and to include good actors and prosper with them. If you look at this constitutional framework and you recognize that, it has not been capable, it has been incapable of assisting the forces that would go in and misuse it. What's very interesting is if you've got a business that misuses its production line and produces things that are bad, versus if you've got politicians who go in and misuse the governmental system, typically the business will either go out of business or have to realign itself and serve the customer. Now, oftentimes these businesses will go out of business or they'll be bought up and changed by other businesses. In the United States government case, if you've got the government failing, the Constitution failing to hold back the politicians come and go. But the corrupt governmental system continues, and it has continued in the United States to accrue power unto itself, as opposed to a private company which is doing a bad job. There's no way it could continue to accrue power unto itself. So there's a stark difference between the way the market functions and the way a government system functions. And the reason the market functions in that way is because it is addressable to the money in the hands of the people, and they have the freedom to withhold it. And government doesn't allow that freedom.
Yeah, I mean, people vote in government once a year, and the effects of that are minimal. People vote in the market every single day, all the time. The market or business, free enterprise, must respond to signals to survive. The government does not have that inconvenience. If you put something together and say, wow, look at our business plan. This is just terrible what we're going to do. Look at the horrors we'll be able to accomplish in 50 years. Now let's go out and get some money. You're out of business almost immediately. But, yeah. In government where the market signals do not exist, then, you're exactly right. Exactly what you just said is the outcome.
And in fact, government answers to the perverse incentives that the mercantilist system presents, as opposed to the markets, which have to be transparent to the consumers. The government, it's only answerable to those people who have the greatest sway to get people elected or not elected. So you have special interests, and you have mercantilist interests in particular. And the Abraham Lincoln story is a perfect example of that. The actions of Abraham Lincoln in his aggression against the South and what he did had nothing to do with some sentimental feeling about Africans and slavery. In fact, he said that if he could continue the Union without freeing one slave, he would. He didn't think that blacks were equal to whites. He thought that they were inferior to whites. He wanted them sent back to Africa. He was not into all this racial harmony stuff that everybody talks about. And he was really driven by the mercantilist interests in keeping the Union together so that Northern interests could continue to make money off of the South. This is one of the major things that is missed in the history of the Civil War. And if you look at what Lincoln did throughout his entire political career, you can see it. It's just plainly obvious that he was a mercantilist through and through. So to me, it's a great example of the pernicious, destructive things that happen in government. And Lincoln's actions are a perfect example of it. And of course, after he set the precedent in destroying the concept that states could leave the Union voluntarily, destroying things like habeas corpus, the entire package of his concept of running through and wiping out entire cities, just killing civilians and things like that. He didn't stop his generals, some of these guys. I mean, Sherman's march was just uncanny, terrible. The Northern prisoner of war camps were truly terrible places. You think about what he did with the Indians. Even that, I mean, geez, I'm crow. Unbelievable, you know? So you say to yourself, I think it's amazing that in education, at least a few of these things don't come out, but clearly they like the idea of the so-called great nation. And they look in the education establishment, they look at America, the contiguous United States, the great nation, and they overlook the millions of people who died, the lives that were destroyed, the rules that were broken, and it continued apace after Lincoln.
the night.